Wow, we're just falling apart. We got all kinds of audio problems this week.
No, this one was, I just turned a dial.
Let's get it together. Here we go.
I was peeking.
Nothing is allowed to break.
You know, and here's the thing, right? Like I remember. I'm gonna be old man Rothfuss for a second here. Like
I remember when movies cost a nickel and you got a free hot dog.
I remember when computers actually fucking worked, you know? That's how old I am, right? I remember my first computer was a fucking Sperry. It had no hard drive. Everything ran off 5.5-inch floppy disks. And like,
back
if you wanted
day,
to
you
change
had two,
something,
two hardy mares, and they would pull you across the land, and you only needed to feed them oats.
These fucking programs worked. And if you wanted to change them, you had to unscrew the case and like reset hard toggles on cards in your thing. And then you know what? And then it just fucking – it did what it was supposed to do. Now, it was hard getting it to that point because there were not good interfaces. There was no internet to go to figure out what the fuck this file error meant. But
these newfangled automobiles, they're always on the fritz.
You know, if cars crashed as often as computers did
– cars are computers now. That's all they are. They're just computers with wheels. Like if the computer goes bad, the car is just totaled now. Like you can't fix a car. It's just a computer in there. The whole system, it's so brittle, Pat. It's going to come crumbling down any moment.
Well, and like it's a little reassuring to me because I've been listening to a lot of Mabim Bam lately. And do you listen to the McElroys?
I do. I'm a big Mabim Bam fan. That is the McElroy Brothers podcast, my brother and me. That I believe, Pat, when you were on that podcast, I was like, holy shit, this is a big deal. And you were like, yeah, I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was on their podcast, honestly, before I kind of knew anything about them. The only thing I had watched at that point was like in like the smallest and silliest of one of their projects, which is Griffin's Meebo Corner,
mm-hmm.
which cracked me up, right? But they're like, oh, I want to be on a podcast. I'm like, sure, I do podcast. And then later I'm like, oh, like this is... And then when that podcast aired, everyone's like, holy shit, you're on Mabim Bam. I'm like, oh, is this a big deal? now I'm a huge fan. But, you know, I've been listening through their backlog. And there's been a couple times when they come on and they're so salty because they're so angry that like they've lost an audio track or like they've just spent 20 minutes trying to get their calls to sync up. And it makes me feel a little better because, you know, like me running my live stream or, you know, us doing this podcast, sometimes like, oh, shit, speaking of, I've got to record this on my end.
Nah, just skip it. I gotcha.
Nah, that's cool. I need to get into the habit here.
Okay.
Audacity. And okay, record there. Anyway, bitch, the end.
well, I don't know what the hell we're talking. Oh, college, right.
College. Okay, I'll take you one more run at this.
Yes, okay, here we go.
Back here, this is old man Rothfuss the second time. You know, we had all these projects due, like typically big term papers or presentations or something in these classes. And and what would happen is you get increasingly more freaked out towards the end of the semester and you get busier and busier and you've got to do more and more stuff. And then you finally get it all done because you have to, right? It's the end of the semester. It's finals. Then you're going to go home. And so you finish off your projects, you finish the semester. And then afterwards you're like, because then either you go into summer break or you go into winter break and you have a couple of weeks off. And I don't know about you, but a lot of times I was sort of like, And what do I do now that I'm not frantically running my ass off trying to finish all of this shit?
Well, you know what was incredible? And we've talked about this before, but you know what was incredible for me is like I would always be in a state of procrastination. I would get so anxious about, you know, like I was a philosophy major, right? So I had a lot of paper, like you were saying, for, you know, a lot of liberal arts degrees. I had like papers that, you know, you're supposed to be doing reading and keeping up with this work and all this stuff throughout the semester. Of course, I'd be doing the bare minimum, if anything, the whole semester. Yeah. And then you'd get, you know, you'd have to turn in a term paper at the end, like a huge, you know, omnibus paper that covered the whole work of the class. And like, you know, it was like, like I'd be so screwed because I'd wait until the day before it was due and I hadn't, and I'd be like, okay, I just need to read these 12 books and come up with a thesis and, you know, compose this paper. And I'd be in a state of panic, and the whole time I would be playing like fucking Snood or like Endless Vase Breaker on Plants vs. Zombies or some dumb fucking mindless leech of a game that was just sucking my soul out one game after another, because it would that little dopamine high was so preferable to the anxiety attack of doing my work. And then you'd finish the work and you'd turn it in or not, you know, as the case may be, and you'd be on break or whatever, the semester would end, and suddenly like this game that I was like clinging to like a life raft in the ocean, it would just like, I would suddenly see like, oh my God, this game is so boring, I have nothing to do.
I like that you played Snood. I did a ton of Snood, but this was like way, way, way back, in the before times. Yeah, it's, and the other thing is like, and some people don't know this, a lot of people do, like I spent, you know, either 9, 11, or 15 years in college, depending on how you count it.
Well, that makes my 5 years sound downright efficient.
Yeah, 5 years is super efficient, man.
Yeah, I just did one victory lap. I mean, that's
you know, nothing. After 9 years, I got my my bachelor's. And then I went and I got my master's degree after an excruciatory 2 years. And, you know, I kind of assumed after 9 years, I'm like, I love college. And the only reason I left is because they pretty much made me. And then I'm like, wow, if college is cool, then grad school is like super college and it should be like double cool. And it was not. It was like masturbating with a cheese grater. But then I came back and I was a teacher for a couple of years as well. And so for the majority of my adult life, I had, you know, like spring, summer, fall, winter, like that was those were the seasons, but my true clock was set to the academic year.
I still get, when it becomes spring and it's sort of that period of like the end of the school year, I still get a like almost like a general anxiety because I'm like, ooh, like something's going to happen soon. Like I'm going to have to turn in all this work.
I don't get that. Well, but what's funny is as a teacher, it's very much the same, except it's just slightly offset because believe me, like everyone out there, who is still in college or looking toward college, as much work as it is for you to write that paper, it is more work for your teacher to grade it effectively. I've always envied these other teachers that do like Scantron tests or anything like that, because, you know, like even at just like a little one page, two page paper, if you're teaching a full-time load, that means you have 100 students at best. You know, imagine not just reading 100 pages, because that's not hard, you know, but reading and like effectively critiquing, evaluating, and providing formative feedback on 100 papers, you know, and at the end of the semester, those research papers are like, you know, 8, 10, 12, 15 pages long. But anyway, so like you have that workload as a teacher too. And then you finish as a teacher, like, oh, I submitted my grades. Now I can move on with my life. But at the same time, I was like, what do I do when I am not constantly either grading or freaking out about grading papers?
I'm still in kind of a bad mood based on this experience I had in playing Overwatch last night. And Pat, I know that you're a keen observer of human behavior, and I'm hoping you can help me understand what went down in this Overwatch game last night.
Okay.
So I was playing with Josh from a fellow Cards Against Humanity co-creator Josh, and we were a team of two, and we were doing competitive. And, I'm a good Overwatch player. I would say I'm like a high, my sort of like natural correct rank in Overwatch would be like, I'm like a mid to high gold level Overwatch player. But for whatever reason, this season I did my placement matches and I just screwed them up. Or I think a lot of people had trouble with their placement matches. I think they changed the placement thing. And I wound up placing into silver. And I'm having a hell of a time digging out of silver, because the problem is when you're playing in like the like low like silver ranks, you get paired up with these dinglings that aren't good at the game, and they don't communicate with each other, and they can't put together a strategy. And it's very hard. It's basically a flip of a coin if you get a team that you can work with or not. And sometimes you play on a team where like no one will be a healer, or no one will be a tank, and no one, you know, it's like you're just stuck in this like dredges of competitive. So I'm trying to partner up with like real life friends and just like claw my way back up to the surface into the like reputable echelons of society in Overwatch. Because the other problem with being in silver is you're really in there with the trash people. I mean, this is like you're in the trash compactor in Star Wars, and that worm creature, that's what you're playing with. It's just these like gutter monsters. And I was having a very bad night dealing with these assholes in Silver League. You know, the people who wouldn't change. They were playing Hanzo on attack and they wouldn't change. And we were just begging, like, please, please change your character, please. And they wouldn't do it. And here's what broke me was we were playing in this game, and we like almost had, like, we could have won this game had our team been 10%, 5% more coordinated. It was so close. And in the last rally, we all got ourselves grouped together. People stopped trickling in one by one and dying like idiots. And we all had the team grouped up. Like, most people were sort of on voice chat. That's the other thing people may not know. You're on voice chat with these like six random morons that you're playing. You know, it takes all kinds, Pat. You get all kinds of weirdos on there. And so Josh and I have like kind of, we're begging people like, please group, stay grouped up. Let's go in together. We have 15 seconds, you know, one last push. We're going to get on the point and try and hold this thing. Turn this game around and win and you know, get our ranking back. And we're playing with this guy who's playing Reinhardt, and he's such a moron. This Reinhardt's been screwing us the whole game, just constantly dying, and he'll get us halfway through a charge and then let his shield down so everyone dies. I mean, this guy just sucks, and we're trying to coach him. We're trying to be like, okay, like, put your shield up and walk us in there. And before the whole team gets together with like 15 seconds left or whatever, you know, minute left or whatever, it was our, you know, our last big push, he just goes charging in there like a moron alone and dies immediately. And I was mad, and I was like, Reinhardt, like, what are you doing? Like, don't go charging in there, because now we don't have our tank that's going to lead us on the point. And the guy goes, dude, calm down. Like, I'm just really high right now. I'm just really high. So just chill out. Like, it's just a game. And I was like, well, why are you playing competitive? Like, if you're high and you don't want to be part of a team and like think, and which is fine. Lots of people play games and they don't want to take it seriously. That's fine. Just play quick play on Overwatch, right? Where it's not ranked. Like, why are you playing competitive and subjecting the other five people on your team to your awfulness and your inability to play because you're high? And he just fucking takes off on me, and he goes, I voted for Trump, bitch. I can do whatever I want. I voted for Trump, and called us fags, which was a delight. I haven't been called a fag in since middle school. That was very pleasant. And I was just stunned. And he was like, I could do anything. I voted for Trump. Trump won. I can do whatever I want. And of course we lost, obviously. Goes without saying. And I just immediately quit Overwatch. Like, I just walked away because I was so stunned. But like, what, do you understand that interaction? Can you, like, what happened? Well, I don't understand any of that. Why, what is Trump? I just don't, I'm
okay. Okay, here's my take. I actually, as much as I might want to blame this on a particular mindset, I think that the political angle is largely irrelevant here.
But it does beg the question, because I did not say, as a Hillary Clinton voter and a liberal who believes that all people should be, you know, fairly represented in society, please play Reinhardt better. I actually didn't lead with that. All I said was, please don't go charging in there alone, like work as a team. And then he replied, and he goes, I voted for Trump, bitch.
It's, I think, okay, I've actually got three different angles on this now. The big one is, and where did I see this behavior? Oh, you know, I was down, I had my extended family Christmas, and, I had my extended family Christmas, and, while it was snowing a ton, I don't know how much of it you got in Chicago, but, it snowed a ton over the weekend, and I live kind of out in the country, or the old family homestead is a little out in the country. So there's like a quarter acre of driveway to deal with. And normally my sister and my dad, they take care of it. But they saw somebody plowing the neighbor's driveway. And my sister went over and was like, hey, would you like to do our driveway? And he goes, sure. You know, he's out here already, goes out and does a great job. And while he's doing it, and when I say does a great job, I mean, I actually admired the craft that this person put into plowing the driveway. You know, like it was very mindful. It was obviously this person had been doing it for a long time. Didn't just like pack snow in wherever it would go most easily. You know, like actually took extra time and effort to make sure that everything was really good. But as he was coming down the driveway, you know, because I was sitting at the bottom of the driveway with Sarah. We were waiting for him to finish before we drove up. We had just come back from some holiday shopping. And so he comes down and he plows, goes back up, comes down, plows, goes back up, comes down, and goes off the driveway into the ditch. Not the whole truck, mind you, mm-hmm. just the front left-hand wheel.
Mm-hmm.
However, it goes down into a hole that is off the driveway. He couldn't see because there was snow, and his truck is stuck. And he's there with another guy. They have two trucks. They're doing this together. And he is stuck at the bottom of our driveway for probably an hour and a half. And
what, just hanging out in the car?
Oh no. Like you're trying to get out.
Oh, I see.
And my dad immediately comes down. He's like, hey, can I help pull you out? Talks for a while, whatever. And the guy, you know, and I can tell that this guy, you know, and because my dad is there and he wants to help because, you know, guess where I get it from, right? You know, he wants to fix things. He wants to help people. He wants to make the world better. It's just knee jerk. There's no way my dad could have not come down there to try to help. And the guy's like, no, we're okay. We got to dig this out. We got to do this. He goes, I don't want you to like damage your, you know, car pulling my like old beater plow truck out of this ditch. But at the same time, my dad, since this is his driveway, there's no way he can like just say, okay, good luck and leave. So he like stays down there. He uses his headlights to kind of keep it illuminated, and he's sticking around in case he can be of help. So eventually the guy gets out of there, and when it happens, he comes over. And he says, you know, he goes, that's the damnedest thing where that cuts, you know, it's kind of deep. He goes, that's really weird. He goes, you know, a lot of these, you know, these driveways, they didn't really put in a real culvert. They did this, and that's why there's stones there. And he starts talking about it, and he's like, you know what I might do? He goes, I'm going to go get a couple of markers for you, and I'm going to put markers in there. He goes, not for me, not for whoever you get to plow this, but for like any guests you have, because that's really atypical there. But, you know, really what was going on is dude was just embarrassed that he went into the fucking ditch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the root of all of the behavior that he was going to exhibit. And truthfully, I get it. Like we all feel dumb when we fuck up. But here's the thing. At the same time, nobody ever wants to admit that they actually fucked up. And evolutionarily, it's shown that it's actually – you're much more survivable if you are the sort of person – I mean in a very old way, you know, in like an old school evolution like Darwinistic thing. You know, fortune favors the bold. You are likely to be more evolutionarily successful if you just kind of make up your mind and you fucking charge ahead and you do your thing. And if you fuck up, you don't dwell on it. Really, this guy in the driver, because he came over to the car and he said, so sorry. But again, first talked about all of these things. And then he said, but he goes, I've been plowing driveways since 72 when I did it with my dad. You know, and just kind of seeded that into the conversation, which is him, you know, but all of this was him saying, number one, I know what I'm doing. Number two, I'm super not a fuck up. Number three, that totally wasn't my fault. And the reason I just went off onto that big story cul-de-sac is if you look at your guy, you know, what did he do? You know, it's like first thing, it's like, oh, dude, it's totally not. It's just super fucking high right now. Which is the equivalent of him saying, it's not really my fault if I suck.
Hmm.
Second off, you know, and then when you said, and did you actually say, why not do quick play? Why are you in competitive?
Yeah, that was what I said. I said, well, why? I said, if you want to get high and just screw around, don't. Why would you play competitive?
Right. And so now again, you know, he knows on some level that he fucked up, right? Because competitive is for people who are supposed to be taking the game seriously. And everybody knows that. If he's been playing any amount of time, he knows that. So that, but it's, you know, one of the hardest things to do psychologically is to, especially in the middle of one of these situations, admit that you have fucked up and you are currently fucking up. And so he could either go, boy, shit, you're right. I'm an asshole and I've inconvenienced all of you. And what's more, and more importantly, probably, is like, I have been an asshole for a long time because I do this all the time. But nobody, it's rare to find a person who will actually admit to that. Instead, what he did is he looked for a scenario within which his behavior was acceptable and therefore not asshole behavior. And that is like, hey, you know, fucking whatever, man, I can do whatever I want. I'm, you know, and that is like, you know, it's okay to engage in behaviors that previously society has frowned on, you know, being racist and sexist and all of these things, you know, because he has backed this person. Now, and then here's the third part is a lot of the delight that Trump people have these days is in watching liberal people freak out. And so I think that is also a factor. Is it's sort of the equivalent of a smoke bomb. It's like, oh, was I an asshole? He's going to throw down that smoke bomb and watch people go, you know, and he's like, I voted for Trump. I can do whatever I want, knowing that a significant portion of the internet is just going to have a conniption fit due to that statement. And then suddenly he doesn't have to defend his assholery.
Hmm.
So those are my three different off the cuff thoughts about like where he was coming from mentally.
So it sounds like there's an element of like a, like, so what you're saying is like the point you were making about that he sucks and that it's also not compatible with his belief that he does not suck or he's like a good Overwatch player. There's kind of like a cognitive dissonance happening. And when people try to like resolve a cognitive dissonance, that's where they get into that dangerous territory of just like ignoring facts, like making their own reality.
Well, no, I don't think it's the fact that he's bad at Overwatch. It's the fact that he was being confronted with the fact that he was doing something that was wrong. And by wrong, I mean culturally unacceptable. And that thing was kind of, you know, not just being bad at Overwatch, but really not playing responsibly, which in that culture is very much valued. And so, again, not being bad at something, but behaving badly. And that's really because, like, we all fuck up sometimes, you know, like, and that's embarrassing, but it's way more embarrassing to be called out on your bad behavior.
Well, I'll tell you what it felt like, because now I'm kind of, you know, this is helping me sort of understand even why it felt so bad on my end. Was I was sort of saying to him, you know, the subtext of this conversation is saying, like, dude, you're being selfish in a way that's hurting these people who are on your, literally on your team, right? We're all supposed to be a team. We're all trying to win together and accomplish this common ends, and your selfish behavior is harming us. And it sounds, and then what it felt like, what he said was, hey, fuck you, man. Like, I have all the power here, and I voted for Trump, and Trump is in charge, and so I don't need to care about anyone else now. I don't need to worry about harming other people now. It doesn't matter. I can do anything I want. I can harm anyone with no consequences because I have all of the power.
There is potentially true that that is the case. That would not be one of my primary things. That would not be one of my primary go-to explanations. He obviously used that, but I mean, honestly, if he really felt that way, why would he feel the need to shout about it? He could have gone there right away. Hmm. I suspect it's much more likely that, you know, and now what that might be is he's revealing maybe some real underlying strata of his psyche. You know, there might be some icky shit in there. And truthfully, I think way deep down, all of us have some of that deep-seated monkey shit going on. It's like, don't tell me what I can't do. I'm the boss. I'm the biggest fucking monkey. You know, listen to me. Fuck you. That's the monkey talking. That's not the human being. So, yeah, I think to a certain extent. But, you know, to pin that on a particular, you know, political inclination, it could be that certain people that's closer to the surface are more prevalent and therefore they behave certain ways or they vote certain ways. But again, that wasn't his go-to. He only got there when he got really riled. And that means that, you know, yeah. It is interesting, though.
So I also noticed, like, during the nights of the debates and, like, the nights that there would be some sort of big – during the nights of the RNC, I was playing a lot of Overwatch during the campaign. It was sort of my primary, like, you know, unwind and not think about politics for a little bit. And during the nights when there would be big – Trump would be have some big event and everyone would be paying attention to Trump, the user behavior standards in Overwatch would crumble. I mean, it would just plummet. Like, people would become – it felt to me like people would become emboldened. Like everyone, all the assholes would just come crawling out. It was like lifting up a rock and all these like little critters and maggots come crawling out from underneath. And they're all on Overwatch just griefing and trolling and playing poorly. And something about seeing Trump just triggered this in people.
Yeah. Well, I would probably say it would be more, I would say it would probably be more everyone. I don't think like seeing Trump, you know, my gut there is that everyone was really nervous, really scared, really upset, really anxious. And those emotions do not evoke good behavior in people, you know, of any political or philosophical bent. You know, when you're in high stress emotional situations, you are a little more likely to, you know, to default to some of this monkey behavior. And monkey behavior is what makes you an asshole. You know, there's a great scene that actually sort of belies this particular thing. It wasn't a great movie. But it was, and it's old. It has to be 15 years old. It had Kyle MacLachlan in it, who I love. And it was about a little suburb, and suddenly all the power goes out and all the radios go out. And it's like, what happens to their little society when suddenly just all this shit stops working and nobody knows why or what's going on. And it starts with little things, because like the first day, you know, Kyle MacLachlan character, he has a kid and he, you know, he runs, his little baby has an ear infection and he knows what the ear infection looks like. He knows the medicine he needs, but like he can't make an appointment with a doctor. He can't do whatever, but he goes to the local pharmacy and he's like, hey, my kid has an ear infection. I need this antibiotic. And they're like, all of our computers are down. We can't give anything out without that authorization. And he's like, my little kid has a fever and she's screaming her head off. I know it. I can see it right there. I've done this before. I just need that pink stuff right there. And they're like, I can't, you know, we don't have authorization. We can't access prescriptions. And, you know, of course, everybody else is there trying to fill their prescription. It's a little bit of a mob scene. And Kyle MacLachlan like jumps the counter, grabs his shit and leaves before anybody can do anything to him. And pretty much everyone at that point is like, yeah, you know, that is the right thing to do. Like you have broken rules, you know, but you are very justified in doing that. But that's like 2 days into this catastrophic event. And then as the movie progresses, it goes longer and longer and things are weird. Then the guns start coming out. Resources get legitimately scarce. And there's this beautiful scene where I think he's taken his family and he's trying to get somewhere else. He's moving away from this population dense area. You know, things have gotten really bad. And he finds like a little house and he thinks it's abandoned, but it's locked, and he breaks in to get his family like in from the inclement weather or the cold or for whatever reason. And so he breaks in, and as he's there, somebody else is there. And of course, at this point, he's acquired a gun. Things are getting kind of desperate. And so he's in there and the other person comes out and this other person has a gun and they start shouting at each other. And they're like, put it down. No, you put it down. I swear to God, I'm going to do this. No, you don't know. Like my family. And they're shouting. And it's this insane, intense scene. And because, and you know that this man is just defending his home. Like he's holed up here with his family. You know, the Kyle MacLachlan's character, he's got his family. You know that neither one of them are bad people, but here's what's really interesting. They're shouting at each other. They're pointing these guns at each other. And then like in order to emphasize, like one of them has a shotgun, one of them has a pistol, and they're shouting. And this, you're like, this could not get any more tense. And then one of them, like to prove their point, to prove how serious they are, he pulls the gun away from pointing it at the other person. He moves it away and he just shoots like into a wall. And then he brings it back and he says, I'll do it. I'll do it. I'll do it. You put your gun down. And the other guy is like, no, you put your gun down. And he moves his shotgun away and he shoots at nothing, right? As if to say like, look at me, like I can do this. My gun does have ammunition. I will fire it. But they go back and forth and neither one of them will do it. It's this amazing scene. I don't know if the overall movie really holds any water, but 20 years later, I remember this scene. And what it is and what it really reveals is the difference. Like we get in these stressful situations and our primate heritage comes out. And that says, you fucking thump your chest. You be the biggest monkey. You take what you need. You do what you have to. But what was so amazing in that scene is you saw that even with all of that pushing them, even in these desperate circumstances, even in defense of their own families, neither one of these people was bad. And neither one of these people was a killer, even though it might have been entirely justified. you know, from their perspective. It's like, I got to defend my family. You know, I got to defend my home. I've got to do what's important. And because neither one of them could do it, you know, eventually they realized that, like, this was just really bad and dumb. And then they had no choice but to talk. I really want to watch that movie again to see how much of this scene I remember accurately. But you know, that's I think what's so much of going on in the world right now. The internet, Facebook and Twitter, all of these things, they're outrage machines. And they do other things, but the main mechanism, the main effect they produce in people is they give people the ability to be exposed to things that outrage them and offend them and hurt them and scare them. And while at the same time allowing people to propagate information that will offend, hurt, outrage, and scare other people. And because of that, everyone is in a constant state of horrified arousal. And I mean that in like a biological sense, like you're in a fight or flight state constantly. It's bad for you psychologically. It's bad for you physically. And it's catastrophic socially because like my girlfriend and I just had a fight on the phone and we both felt accused and we both felt angry. And because of that, we were both shitty to each other. And so it escalates. And like, luckily, you know, we hung up and we'll cool down and be better to each other later. But on the internet, there is no hanging up. Twitter is always going to be there showing you information that makes you want to fucking puke.
Well, and you know what else? You know what else on Twitter? You're not just having a conversation with someone on the phone. You're performing the conversation for an audience.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So you have even less incentive to ever admit that you're wrong or de-escalate or have any nuance or show any ability to compromise or have any compassion towards someone who's in the out-group. Because then the audience will turn on you.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's the stakes are always higher when you're public. And even when things are not, and on the internet, things either feel more public than they really are, or they feel less public than they really are. And either one of those misapprehensions is going to fuck you.
Well, this is making me think about this game I made in college. It was actually my first like foray into gaming. I never had any. I never really had all that much interest in games, honestly. Like, I played games as a kid, but I never had any aspirations to like be a game designer or make games or have a career in games. Like, I didn't even really take them seriously. And when I was in college, my friends and I made this game called Humans vs. Zombies, and we never had any ambition to like make a cool game. All we had these Nerf guns, and we were playing like assassins, and we were just like, it would be cool if we like came up with something to do with these Nerf guns. And we started this game of tag that was like zombie tag, and it quickly went from like there was like 60 of us playing to we wound up getting like half of the school playing, and by the time we graduated, it was being played at like 600 different colleges and universities like all over the country. And that was sort of my entry into like figuring out game design and learning that there was this world of indie games and like big games. And along the way, we made this game in 2005. So it was, oh no, I'm sorry. We made this game in 2005. Oh my God. It's been 10 years. And, we rode like a wave of, zombie culture. So this was like right as like Walking Dead was becoming a thing. It was like right when there was tons of zombie movies coming out, like 28 Days Later. And I became obsessed with this question of like, as Humans versus Zombies like became this huge nationwide and worldwide like phenomenon that we were just sort of like clinging on to and desperately trying to keep up with, and like zombies were taking over like all pop culture and becoming like the monster of our generation. Like, I feel like generationally, like, people my age have just had nothing but zombies in their, for their entire life, as like the monster that represents the fears of our generation. I became obsessed with this like question of like, what, why zombies? Like, what is this? What does it mean? And I think there's like, I had like two reads on it, which is like, one, zombies are post-apocalyptic, and it's about the real monster in zombie movies are the humans, because it's about when the like niceties of society fall away, how quickly people just like crumble, like all our conventions of society and our empathy just falls to pieces. And, you know, zombies are the perfect sort of monster to represent that collapse and to cause that collapse, because zombies represent, it's like the mass of humanity just becoming like unthinking, violent horde, you know, unquestioning, like just go, just eat, you know, eating people and going nuts. And there were times like during the Bush administration when I think people felt like that, like when we were going to war in Iraq in 2003, it felt like a zombie takeover. It was like, what? These people have all gone insane. Like, they stopped thinking. So I think that was like, I always attributed that, that why zombies like spoke so powerfully to our generation is like people reacting to the Bush years and like, man, like I can't even wait to see what comes out of that. What monster comes out of the Trump administration that people fear?
Yeah. You know, there was, I want to say it was on, Cracked. It was one of the after hours talks. Have you watched those?
No, I'm not familiar.
Oh my Christ. That's, it's a little silly, but Cracked, has produced some of the really the finest humor that I have consumed over the last several years.
Is this like the Cracked like lists that they do?
You know, and you know, they do those lists as well, although some of them, the ones with the psychological bent, are remarkably well researched and with good underpinning. But their videos, one of the videos was effectively, I mean, they kind of wrap it in humor and, you know, pop culture. And then they're like, you know, why, you know, they do a little 8-minute video with people to like, what's the fucking deal with all the zombie movies? Or what's the deal with horror movies? And one of their theories was that, you know, the zombie movie is pretty much what you said, is the zombie movie is the Democrat or the liberal fear of the stereotypical like straw man Republican, where these people don't think, they are just mindless followers of impulse.
Don't Republicans fear this too? Because they're the people who are all about the rugged individualism and every man's house is a castle and the strong man pulls himself up from his bootstraps. They love the idea of the power of the single man in society to make a difference, and they hate the idea of the collectivist, you know, Obama, like we're all in this together and we're all gonna sacrifice for each other.
No. It's what their take on it was that, you know, the liberal thinks of Republicans as zombies.
Oh, I see.
And okay. Where it's like, you just follow, you're mindless, you just do this thing and you destroy, you know, just through your mindless progression through whatever. But the Republicans, their fear is they view Democrats as vampires.
They're all teenagers who want to fuck.
No,
vampires is teenagers who want
to
fuck.
Well, to a certain extent, but the stereotypical perception of liberals is that we're going to consume without producing, and that we are deviant and that we are hypersexualized, and all of those things are true about vampires. Of course, Cracked did this honestly more in depth, more spot on with references and funny, but it was a really interesting comparison, and I think there might be a little bit to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something to like why I mean, you know, I don't know how much you get into this like Jungian, like, you know, sort of collective unconscious idea, but there is something to like when a monster mean something to a generation, like, it must be some reason that it, like, speaks to their fears, right? And the zombie thing, to me, it was always the sort of post... I feel like my generation is almost like a post-apocalyptic, like, generation. Like, they feel... I don't know. Like, everyone just feels like takes it for granted that, like, society is so precarious. Maybe it's global warming or the sort of imbalance of wealth or the economic collapse of 2008 or 9/11 or who knows. But I think it's like people can almost like see the cracks of how brittle some of these institutions are in society.
I think a part of it is wish fulfillment, because I do admit, like, if society collapsed, the things that would go away, you know, and here's the thing, on the surface, right? On the surface, the things that would go away are the things that are a constant burden to me, and that even though I pursue them actively, subconsciously I know that they make me miserable.
No more phone updates when society collapses.
Yeah, no phone updates. Okay, let me paint you a picture, everyone out there in podcast land. Let me tell you a story of a world in which you never had to answer email again. A story in which you never had to see that the political team that opposes you and that repulses you is trending on Twitter. Let me tell you a story of a land where you never had to stand in line at the DMV, or you never had to deal with all of the inconvenient, time-wasting, fiddly bullshit that society pours on you and that consumes an increasingly large portion of your day. You never had to deal with any of that again. And you know, I'm kind of selling after the close, because I know I had you as soon as I said you never had to answer email again.
Okay. So I mentioned a while back that my favorite book that I read this year was this book called Station 11. I sent you a copy. It'll get there this week or next week. But I love this book, and it was a short little fiction book. And the premise of the book is a really bad strain of flu suddenly becomes a global pandemic, wipes out most of the population, society collapses, and it follows a troupe of Shakespearean actors who travel from sort of town to town about 20 years after the collapse and perform Shakespeare for people. And it's this meditation on what technology means and what society means. The writing is beautiful, and instead of talking, it's a fascinating post-apocalyptic sort of fiction book, because instead of talking about how people survive and the people shooting guns and all of that, it almost exclusively focuses on why people survive, and it focuses on the stories that we tell and culture, and how does culture get preserved and what does that mean. And there's right in the introduction of the book, in the top, there's this quote that has been like this little section that's been like haunting me ever since I read it. And it just comes as a little short chapter that sort of almost interrupts the narrative. And it just starts like this. An incomplete list. No more diving into pools of chlorinated water lit green from below. No more ball games played out under floodlights. No more porch lights with moths fluttering on summer nights. No more trains running under the surface of cities on the dazzling power of the electric third rail. No more cities. No more films, except rarely, except with a generator drowning out half the dialogue, and only then for the first little while until the fuel for the generators ran out, because automobile gas goes stale after 2 or 3 years. Aviation gas lasts longer, but it was difficult to come by. No more screens shining in the half-light as people raise their phones above the crowd to take photographs of concert stages. No more concert stages lit by candied color halogens. No more electronica, punk, electric guitars. No more pharmaceuticals. No more certainty of surviving a scratch on one's hand, a cut on one's finger, while chopping vegetables for dinner, a dog bite. No more flight. No more towns glimpsed from the sky through airplane windows, points of glimmering light. No more looking down from 30,000 feet and imagining the lives lit up by those lights at that moment. No more airplanes, no more requests to put your tray table in its upright and locked position. But no, this wasn't true. There were still airplanes here and there. They stood dormant on runways and in hangars. They collected snow on their wings. In the cold months, they were ideal for food storage. In summer, the ones near orchards were filled with trays of fruit that dehydrated in the heat. Teenagers snuck into them to have sex. Rust blossomed and streaked. No more countries, all borders unmanned. No more fire departments, no more police, no more road maintenance or garbage pickup. No more spacecraft rising up from Cape Canaveral, burning paths through the atmosphere into space. No more internet, no more social media, no more scrolling through litanies of dreams and nervous hopes and photographs of lunches, cries for help and expressions of contentment and relationship status updates with heart icons, whole or broken, plans to meet up later, pleas, complaints, desires, pictures of babies dressed as bears or peppers for Halloween. No more reading and commenting on the lives of others, and in so doing, feeling slightly less alone in the room. No more avatars.
No more email. It's that's very well written and it's very well said. This whole episode might be nothing but old man Rothfuss, really. Here's the sad truth. Left to our own devices, humans make bad choices and we make them persistently. Left to our own devices, following evolutionary imperatives that once were essential to us, we become fat to the point where we die. I will eat a pizza every goddamn night of my life unless the human part of me restrains that impulse. Similarly, you will play snood, to the detriment of your education. It'd be in search of that, that serotonin bump. And similarly, groups of humans engage in behavior that is to the detriment of all humans. and in the same way that I feel that in order to be our best selves, we kind of have to work to moderate and we have to work with our monkey natures and decide which of these impulses we will work with and which ones we will work against. And as groups of humans, I feel like the purpose of our government and our governing bodies and our regulatory systems is to keep groups of humans from behaving like single monkeys, by which I mean having one monkey or consume all of the fucking fruit, or having one monkey shit in the river so that nobody else can drink there. I think there's this persistent low-level, distaste for so many of these things that we build our lives around these days. I'm on Twitter constantly throughout the day, but also at the same time, I constantly fantasize about leaving Twitter behind. Why? Like, if I was in a relationship, like a personal relationship that benefited, that had a cost benefit analysis like Twitter's, I would leave that friend.
But doesn't Twitter almost delivers the ultimate pleasure to the monkey brain, which is the fantasy of knowing what other people are saying about you and your status in the tribe.
Oh, sure. I'm not saying that it doesn't give people something that they want. But the problem is increasingly in this day and age, what we want is absolutely not what we need. I'm not saying that some of the experiences that you can get you know, and it mentioned in that little passage that you quoted, you know, that, you know, the talking to someone online and feeling for a moment that you're not alone in the room. Well, you know, if you didn't have those things, you know what you would do? You would go out and actually not be alone. I mean, it's not a fucking surprise, people. Guess what happened before the internet? You had real friends in the meat world, and you sat on a couch with them and you watched movies. It was great. Let me tell you of the before times. You know what we did? We got together and we played board games. You know, and we did it all the fucking time. Why? Well, because there was no other option. And, you know, it was good for us. And my heart was happy. And I was so constantly full of joy that I was much more productive in all elements of my life. Yeah.
Well, shit.
This has been a fucking bummer of a podcast. Let's do, again, so I'll admit, and maybe you don't know this, I used to write an advice column. I love answering questions, especially not very serious questions, so I can give bad advice.
Okay.
Now, and I feel like a bit of a wanker here because I was actually, even before I started listening to Bim Bam, I'm like, hey, Max, maybe we could, like, you know, in addition to doing our own topical stuff, maybe we could answer some questions because I like answering questions. Now, of course, that's the entire fucking Mabim Pam podcast. But I just want to say I started doing that shit in 94. So they're biting on my style, well, not the
I,
other way
I also,
around.
I also want to say that I hope that people don't – I love my brother and me. I sincerely hope that people are not listening to that podcast for actual advice.
No. No.
I mean, it's a very good show. It's not an advice show. The right. Yahoos are not, they don't constitute advice.
But, well, and that neither did my advice column. You know, my advice column was mostly, I was just going on Twitter and I see that you beat me to it.
You fast.
In this, like
fast
in a femtosecond, you actually, I'm going to retweet that.
Uh-oh. All right. I got the questions are coming in, Pat. They're coming in fast. You ready?
Okay.
All right. How do you keep the radiance of your beard so glorious? That's the problem with asking people questions. They're going to fucking ask you about the third book and your beard.
Yeah, I know. So Bim Bam has a great rule when they do a live show. They're like, no bummers.
No bummers. No whammies. No whammies.
No, so I think what we'll do is it's not. Here we go. Trin jumped in.
Okay. All right. Why don't you? I'll read you this question from our friend Trin. Trin asks, "What the fuck should I do with my hair? I'm thinking about growing it long, but I worry it is too damaged."
Okay, I've got an answer for this. The whole myth of like, oh, I have damaged hair. Oh, I have split ends. Oh, whatever. It's all a myth. It's all bullshit. None of that is real. You know, like your hair just grows out of your body. And if it grows long, then that means that is okay. You do not need to like rub it with essential oils or pray over it or like, get its aura adjusted with crystals. Just like let it go. Occasionally, if it starts to reek, then you should wash it. This is my entire regimen, is occasionally wash it, mostly leave it alone, and you too will have a glorious mane like Patrick Rothfuss's.
Can you reveal to our listeners what brand of beard oil you use?
There's no beard oil. Do I look like someone who grooms to fucking buy product?
What brand? Well, how about mustache wax? What brand of mustache wax do you purchase?
There's no wax. It's sometimes... You know, those little candy soda bottles, you know, the wax ones, and it has like that juice inside.
Oh my God. What the old man, Pat, I feel like you got 50 years older since the last time we spoke. Well, what's wrong with the hard candy?
What's Werther's original is the best candy out there.
All right. Here's a question from for our friend John. John writes, "Hey Patrick, how do I keep my vegetables fresher longer?"
Your belly is nature's refrigerator. If you have a bunch of vegetables and you're worried about them going bad, just eat them all, because by tomorrow they might have gone rotten. But if you eat them all today, then you will get all the healthful benefits from them all at once, and they will not spoil. And if you eat enough vegetables, I'm pretty sure that's how you become an X-Man. You get mutant powers from all the vitamins.
Pat, you know the whole story about the carrots, that carrots are good for your eyesight. This is like one of my favorites. I feel like it's a classic turns out story, but it's one of my favorites. Do you know this whole thing?
I don't know if I know this thing.
So in World War II, the British discovered radar, and they became very, very good at shooting down German planes. And the Germans started asking, why are the British so good at shooting down our planes, especially like on night missions? And the British, of course, did not want the Germans to know that they invented radar. So they instead started a myth that because British pilots ate lots of carrots, and carrots have some compound in them called beta carotene, which they do. It's true. There's beta carotene. They said, and it's true that it's like possibly marginally slightly beneficial for your eyesight, or if you don't have it, it's bad for your eyesight or something. They started this myth, though, that if you eat a lot of carrots, it improves your eyes. And it was such a good piece of psyops that it persists to this day.
That I love that story. Oh, I love that.
Please,
so much.
Please don't write in if that's not true. I don't want to know. All right, I got some questions coming in. They're coming in fast, Pat.
Okay.
You got ready for some lightning round?
Yep.
All right, Pat, do you have haters? How do you overcome their negativity?
Mostly ignoring, occasional blocking. Very rare snarking.
So you think it's almost never worth it to engage?
Oh no, it's really not.
Because I mean, I guess one way to think of it for me is like well, they already don't like what I'm doing. Like, they're already like sort of not spending their money on me. But the best case scenario for me is I can also let them not steal my time.
Yeah, it's a lesson that I relearned from when I was young, and people picked on me. You know, like in my early days, I did not have a lot of friends, maybe any friends, and you know, back in grade school, and I was fat and I was an easy target and I read books, and so people picked on me, and I realized, like, if you tried to get back or reply or get the better of them verbally, like, that never worked. But if you just ignored them, eventually they got bored and they went away. And I realized that, like, that's actually the best strategy these days in this technological forum as well.
If that is building and there's people harassing you on social media or whatever, what they're hoping for, you know, to some degree, I look at this as a force of nature. It's like standing on the shore and the waves are coming, and it's part of being there. If you're on Twitter, if you're working in public, if you're trying to engage with that audience, the waves are going to come. People will be mad. They will be outraged. They will come for you. They will try to start something. And what they want when they start that is they want a reaction. They want you to say something angry. They want you to say something dumb, because now they got a rise out of you and they're looking for feedback. And if you give them feedback, then they're kind of winning. So it's like if they harass, and then you like start digging in and you quote retweet them and you're giving them zingers and you're doing interviews about it, it's like, well, they've captured your time and attention, and it's like how when a dog barks and then you like start yelling at the dog, you're giving the dog like positive reinforcement for creating the commotion. Like, the best advice I have is you have to become a brick wall, and you have to be immovable and stay on message and never engage with people who are trying to sort of steal your time and attention and disrupt you. And if you're just this like implacable brick wall, eventually the waves will break. They have to. It's like you just have to be stronger than them and not react.
It's a complicated issue, but it's not a bad rule of thumb for me. And again, it's like all those kids teasing me back in the day. It's like if you ignore them, they realize there's really not much in it for them. And then eventually they get bored and they leave. And again, I don't think it solves anything. You know, it's not always the best solution, but it's not a bad rule of thumb.
All right. Final question for today. Do you have any good dip recipes?
Oh, man. I make taco dip like a badass. Yes, I have a great taco dip recipe.
Would you share it with our audience?
You know, these are powerful secrets. I do not know if your average mortal is equipped to deal with this. Maybe I can compile that and maybe provide it for y'all later.
Okay.
I tell you though, it's not good for you. And this is a great example. This, watch me tie it back to earlier in the episode. You can make this dip, but it is so good. At one point, I ate this dip, like nothing but this dip, for 3 days until my body was violently ill in order to stop me from eating more dip and therefore dying probably of scurvy.
Well, Pat, as you know, I'm a man of the people, so not only do I have a dip recipe, but I am willing to share it with our audience. This recipe is courtesy of Lucky Peach Magazine, and it is the best dip I have ever had in my life. It's like a stupidly easy like food hack. Once you learn it, you'll be so mad you haven't been eating this your whole life. Here it is. Now, you know we might have talked about this in the podcast, but whatever. But anyway, here's the recipe. You know how when you get a packet of ramen, there's the flavor powder in a packet? It's like a foil packet of the flavor powder?
Yep.
Okay, here's what you got to do. Get a ramen. Get an interesting ramen, not just like a top noodle, go to your like local Asian grocery store and get a crazy ramen with a really interesting flavor powder. Now, go to the store, get your thing of sour cream. Take the flavor powder, empty it into the sour cream, stir it in there, mix it really well, and now you got to let it sit. The sour cream is it's like super viscous and it takes a while to sort of absorb all of the flavor powder. Put it in the fridge, a couple hours later, get into that dip with some your chip of your choice. I'll do like a plain regular like Lay's potato chip. Holy shit, it's the greatest dip in the world. The flavor powder in ramen is so advanced. It's so good with sour cream on chips.
Yeah. Okay. I can do my taco dip one too. It's pretty simple, right? You get sour cream and cream cheese and you mix them together, like a little 8 ounce container and one of those bricks of sour cream. You can also use the Neuf Chitfetichel or Neufchitel or whatever the version of cream cheese with slightly less fat. But, you know, the truth is, it's like you can drive a 10-inch nail into your heart or an 8-inch nail into your heart. You're fucked either way. So you might as well just eat it with all the fat. And then you take a packet of taco seasoning or two or three, and you mix it in with the sour cream and the cream cheese. And then you put lettuce, tomato, cheese, green onion, olive, like whatever you want. Taco-y on top of that, and then you eat it with chips. And, you know, I've got a confession, right? I said that I ate this once for 3 days until I threw up. That was back in high school. That was a bit of a lie. That's happened more than once, right?
Oh, no.
Yeah. And
truly humanity can never learn.
We can never live. This is where we're monsters. We need to be controlled. Humanity. Well, that's why we need strong government. And that's why I need apparently like whatever the assistant name for like a babysitter, except somebody who just makes sure that
Obama,
I don't
help us. Stop us from eating the taco dip.
Stop me from a taco sitter is what I need. A taco doula.
Dip doula,
a shield maiden, but for my body from myself. Yeah. Now, admittedly, the second time it was just that I made a bunch of taco dip for a party and then we didn't eat all the taco dip. So it was just in my house. I didn't make it for myself and then eat it myself. But the result was the same. I did eat it pretty much exclusively for several days until I became violently ill. So, you know, just with great power comes great taco dip. And with great taco dip, you might throw up. That's the moral of the story.
Well, I feel like that's a good place to leave things for today.
I feel like I've shared a bunch of wisdom.
Very, very wise, Pat, to end on this positive note, giving advice to our listeners. So wise, so wise. All right, talk to you soon.
Cool. I'll see you later.